Excuse me, Carol. Yep. Dave went away for a minute.
No. The only particularly, the only scholar of world renown in the New Testament that I've checked out my thinking with here is Olaf Linton, who is a spiritual son of Anton Friedrichsen, who is my favorite New Testament scholar in this century. And he's a Norwegian who was too liberal for the Norwegians and too conservative for the Swedes. He ended up at Uppsala, their university there. And his particular sons, one of them heads the Harvard Divinity School right now, and another one Basel, and another one at Copenhagen. He's a really great spirit. And he really was impressed and felt that this is exactly what the text is getting across. If you'll notice now, we'll go back into 12 a little bit and see the continuity, because Paul didn't write chapter 13. He's writing a letter. He's not writing a treatise on government or anything else. He's writing a letter to a small minority group in a capital city, and with regard to their problems and getting along with one another is Jew and Roman, really. Jew and Greek, if you would put it that way.
And these chapters, they were assigned arbitrarily.
These are assigned arbitrarily in about the 6th century, yeah. So you always have to see the continuity. And Paul has, through the 11th chapter, had a stirring essay, really, on the whole nature of God's act in history. So he's been talking about, and finally deals with the Jew in history and God's purpose with it. And then in the 12th chapter, he turns particularly to the people of God present in these congregations in Rome, perhaps 4 or 5 now, small household congregations, and he's writing to all of them, one of them perhaps inclined to be largely Judaistic, and the other one, the others perhaps mainly pagan. They may have already started to separate out, as they did later, and had a Jewish Christian group. And he's asking them to get along, really. And what he's asking is that they do get along with each other. And in 12, 1 and 2, this is what he's saying. The world for Paul is a world that is competitive. It's a world continues striving for status. It's a world as it is for our Lord, uses it the same way. You know how the rulers of this world are, but it shall not be so with you. Remember what Jesus says to the disciples. They're contending, fighting about their prestige situation with each other. And that's right on the eve, as you recall, of the Lord's Supper, and who should be greatest among them. And this world is not to determine their relationships. It's not our status and our acceptance in the world that's going to be getting to us. What you kids felt so terrifically about the PLU group, and why I gave them a bit of a thumping yesterday morning, is it was just this. They're so concerned about their image and how they take with each other that they can't be real. I mean, there's something phony about them, and this got you. They couldn't unwind, they couldn't release themselves, their bodies didn't move when they sang a song, and they sort of looked around a little bit to see who else was going to give, you know. It's like when we had our Holden Village dinner at Central with some of the brass present, and they kind of all looked at Schutz, and when they saw Schutz was clapping his hands and stamping his feet, well, they all let go, started to do the same thing, but he had to sort of give the cue to this thing. Or like with our friends in Missouri Synod now, they just made a motion that they will finally acknowledge the fact that the ALC is also Christian, so they can share our pulpits or allow us at the communion tables. The minute they have a majority vote for something like this, all the brothers are in line. Now it's okay, see? As if anything was changed by the vote that wasn't there before. Nothing was, you know. But it just gives them release from their intimidation and allows them to act with what they know already is so, you know. They did elect as their president one of the renegades from our particular synod who said he left the ELC just in time to save his soul. And I've always said publicly, I was so glad he made it. Well, this allowed them then maybe to go the other way and relate the fact that maybe there were a few saved souls amongst us too. But this kind of world, see, that's a competitive world. That's one that do not be conformed, the world be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so on. You may prove it is a good and will of God. You know all this. Then he relates them to each other. He says, by the grace given to me, I mean this kind of a gift of grace he's speaking of from God here to be one of those who have authority in the church. One of those who has the right in the Gentile world to say something, because to him had been given apostleship to the Gentiles as to Peter to the Jew. And now he says, he's asked you not to think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Now this keynotes it, you see. You don't get so hung up on yourself that you think that the truth was born with you and it's going to die with you. See? This is what he's saying here. But to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith which God has assigned him. One of the women who really got bounced but good this summer here and got oh boy, Rosemary gave her several drubbings and so on, and she was a very kindly, very warm, really a very, the kind of person you just all love to know. She was no hung-up legalist or anything, but she had extremely conservative theological background, and this had shaped her. She wrote a letter today, a very darling letter. She said, it hurt, she said, but that's the way learning is. It does hurt. She said, I realized I had to let my God be a little bigger than I had let him be. And that meant I had to realize I wasn't as big as I was. You know, and it was a really wonderful letter. I would love to use it in our newspaper. I won't. Letter I will use in our newspaper. It didn't take long. I'll read tonight from Bruce Larrabee. It's a tremendous thing. But you're trying to think soberly, like Bruce says about himself when he's back in Vietnam now. You just feel like one piece of sand on the beach. Two nuns and five kids were killed in an ox cart by a landmine. And just saying, there's a whole grief and pain of a war situation. What is one person in this? We have to think soberly. Think with sober judgment, according to the measure of faith which God has assigned to him. We're in one body with many members. We've got membranes. We're membranes of one another. It's like the body, and each, the toe can't be the eye, but we do have to be part of the body if it's to function. We do not all have the same function. So we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually membranes one of another. We are really belonging that intimately to each other. We belong that much to one another. You to me, I to you. The village in the summer gets us through to each other, kind of. We function because of this. I haven't heard anybody this summer, it might have occurred to somebody, but I haven't heard no one say it out loud, oh, I got this job, you've got that job, you've got this job, you know. I mean, there are times when I think this way myself. I'd like to take a vacation once, Werner can, but he isn't collecting money. If I'm not collecting money, nobody is. You know, so you just sort of feel like if you shut up the shop, there ain't going to be any customers. You know, this is my position. But we aren't comparing one to another like this. We've each got our task, we're doing it. Well, this is the body of Christ when we're subject one to another. The gifts differ. Having gifts that differ according to the grace given to each of us, we use them. If we can preach, okay, let's do that in proportion to our faith. Let's do it according to what we really believe and not according to what we think we ought to. If service, then we give ourselves to our serving. We're really with it. And we give ourselves, and not just a little bit of our means or a bit of our time, but we give ourselves to this person. He who teaches, you give yourself to your teaching. He who exhorts, his exhortation. He who contributes in liberality, he who gives aid with zeal, he who gives acts of mercy with cheerfulness. And here you have simply a description of what actually happens. And what happens here, it isn't something we can put on. It is what happens when we relate to each other in this way. Each of us taking our particular assigned task as part of the body and doing it. Unto God, not unto man. Just being with it. This is what he's talking about. When this happens, then let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. As you build each other up, you're concerned that nobody gets left out. You acknowledge a job well done. You're grateful for this kind of relationship to one another. We're so happy this summer in a kitchen that has been a morale builder for us instead of, sometimes this has happened, a morale breaker. Never flag in zeal. Be aglow with the Spirit. Serve the Lord. This kind of a spontaneity of love that can't be commanded by regulation is what he's describing. He knows by saying this he can't produce it, but it's what's happening when we are one body. Rejoice in your hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saint, practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless, do not curse them. Don't get on the defensive now, in other words. You're in control, the hope is yours, the future is yours, you can bear with those who can't see you. I just have felt sorry for the ones who haven't been with the village, for instance, haven't been with it. They're like people who don't buy stock when it's cheap. And they don't come in on the 100% annual raise that it's going to have. You see, and this has been the village. We've known this from the start that we couldn't really fail with it. This is something that's way overdue for the church. And we can take its neglect and move on. Well, this is the way the church knew itself. It was the heir of eternity, and it was with it. You're with him who's at work in history. You're not in a daydream. You're in a historical activity. So then you can have this kind of relationship of objectivity, really. You're not going to get flippish the minute somebody flips a chip with you. You're going to rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. You've got time to be human. You can live in harmony with one another, not be haughty, but associate with the lowly, not be conceited. This got me terribly this summer. One of our faculty was just great last summer. We went out of here one day when one of the profs had said he hadn't had time to keep up with the Bible, but you got to leave something go. And we were just talking about this problem. When we were sitting over by the sound, that's where I was now. We had a great time with Rosemary last summer. This summer, because she's withdrawn from her own group, I think, and become alone, she's had to exalt kind of her own brains. And she doesn't lack for brains, but she sure lacks for sense. As we know, and there were times when this condescension was there. Well, this can't happen when we're in one body. Never be conceited. What a difference when Marty came in, or Roland Bainton, or really superb scholarship of top order. Roland Bainton, who in several areas is a world authority and gets quoted in all languages. I mean, not simply Luther, but Erasmus and conscientious objection and so on, where he knows more about the Erasmus and about conscientious objection than any other man alive, and yet how easily he carries it. And spends his time making caricatures and simply being with it, because he's part of the one body. He actually is, not above it or over it. Well, this is what he's saying here happens in the kind of casual sort of relationship of a common humanity we have. So we don't have to repay evil for evil. We take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If possible, as far as it depends on you, be peaceable with all. There's some people you can't be, and Fritz is going to discuss this tomorrow in hostilities, and you just got to let them write them out. If they're going to feel happy writing out their hostilities on you, just have to let them sometimes and feel sorry for them. But it's, you're not going to go to bed sick every night because they aren't talking to you anymore, or because they're just talking to you too much. Either way, but you leave it alone. See, beloved, never avenge yourself. Leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, "Vengeance is mine; I will repay," says the Lord. You can't live in this kind of tight community, which is the Church of Jesus Christ, without sometimes getting some wounds from one another. But like I tell the boys at the seminary, you let them scar. You don't let them fester. They do scar. They're there. They never heal that completely. Someone should have understood at a time when they just didn't. We miss each other that way. A wonderful thing in marriage is at least you have sex and physical touch to make up for the want of psychical understanding sometimes. But there's no close relationship of any two people which doesn't wound at times and miss one another. He says, so we can live objective to this. And if your enemy is hunger, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. And he figures this is the way you're going to bring him around. And you do, by not holding by your rightness, by going the third mile. So do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And it's in this context, you see, he's talking about this. As we are subject to one another, as we're not trying to get our due and our right, as we're not fighting for who's going to be on the top seat. Now, unless we can learn this as nations, we know right now we haven't got a chance. There simply isn't a chance to have the kind of power play we've been able to enjoy for all these years on this planet and for us to endure on it. We're going to sock each other out. Unless we can finally get to say, as we're going to have to say, all right, if you want it that bad, Rusky, take it. No, we're simply going to have to say that, or else we're not going to go on existing this planet. That's what coexistence means, that you aren't always going to fight for who's stepping on each other's toes. I mean, if we for 1 minute try to put ourselves into the average Russian's shoes right now, how would you feel if you were completely surrounded by United States armament? Every place you looked, you knew blooming well you had a gun aimed at you. Our base is simply surrounded. They're thousands of miles from us. We're on their borders all the way around. You know, and then we get fussed about Vietnam. Where we're fighting the war, how many thousand miles away, you see? This is how crazy our whole attitude is. Well, we've got to learn to live. Something in this particular section is telling us. Now, in relationship then to this kind of world, we're not to be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. This is what he's just said. Are we going to twist the 13th chapter into a militaristic machine that we sanctify and send into the world in the name of being subject to the powers that be? Now, the Prussian military regime was sanctified by the Lutheran theology and permitted to go. Bismarck himself, the epitome of power politics. And the reason why he was so powerful is my history teacher told me, in reading later years some biographies of Bismarck, I find she's right, is because he always did tell the truth, and in diplomacy you never do, so nobody ever believed him. See? And that's why he was the most superb diplomat of his time in Europe. He always told the truth. We're going to go over and sock you out. And everybody thought, ah, what a joker. And then he went over and socked them out. You know, he always told the truth. He was a personal pietist. He was a personally converted Christian man. Bismarck was, incidentally. I mean, he'd had a specific spiritual experience of Jesus Christ. He was a Billy Graham in politics. And knew he was right. You know, this sort of a guy. And interesting that this is so. You can read up on this if you want. But he's the fellow that built the Prussian military machine and made it the finest military machine that we've had in A.D., better than the Romans. You've got to go back to some of the Syrians, I suppose, to get as ruthless a machine as he built up. Because everybody was subject to one another. You didn't question, you see. If that's what the guy ahead of you says, all right, you do it. It's much easier to do it that way, you know. You just don't think anymore. And this becomes the absolute, this idea of authority. Now, this is not what Paul says here at all. In the context of having been saying, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. In the context of saying, bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse them. In the context of saying, outdo each other and showing brotherly affection and showing honor. In the context where he says you're subject to each other and with your gifts you're serving one another, so you're building one another up with the gifts that you're giving and not exalting yourself over against one another, it's in that context that he speaks about our relationship to the authority. Now do we see this? Because then we can read it, you see. Otherwise we tear this like the Lutheran Church did out of its context, and we create a completely demonic situation in which nothing is left to actually counter the kind of demonic aspect that comes into all power and authority. If a father is unquestioned in his own household, you know, and he rules it. One of the members of our family, his name is Marcus Buchmann. He walked like a ramrod when he was 98 years old. He still smoked a cigar continually. And a magnificent specimen of humanity. He was president of our seminary for 60 years. But boy, his kids couldn't make a sound in the house. Father's studying, you know. And the study door was closed. This was it. He was a scholar, and everything revolved around him. And so my cousin Mark had to give up the ministry and support him in his old age, even, because the pension he got from the church was inadequate. And, of course, Mark's job was to support his grandfather. And how crazy can we get? So then his whole life got to be directed around that. Nice, kindly guy. Anything but like me. My cousins aren't. They're very gentle in their spirit. And he did this. But what a shame, you see. This abuse of authority. I had a girl here, and I think we would have seen her healed. Her parents came up here. She went home with them. She was 29 years old, and I pled and I said, "You, gee, stay here. You're starting to come out of it. You're laughing. You're talking with people." And she said, "Well, I've got parents." I said, "You're 29 years old." But she went home with them. And it wasn't a year later when her car was in the garage running, and she was in the car. And the police came to the door after she hadn't appeared for a day. Well, this business of authority destroys. It destroys us when it's used this way. It's demonic. It destroys us as a nation when it's used in this way. When we say my country right or wrong, it's only right in the sense that where I was born remains where I was born, whether or not it's run like hell or like heaven. It's still where I was born. Okay, that's one thing. But to say I obey it, whether it's right or wrong, you see, is another. Now notice in the context here what Paul says. He's been misused so often that I just groan for him. Honestly, been used to beat the women down and make her into a slave in home, and as anything but what he said. No one said more wonderful things about women than Paul. And as I've shown you this summer earlier. And then our South Africaners even use him to keep the black down, you know. There is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. He sees authorities, exousioi is the word here. He sees them personified. He sees them as personified powers. Elsewhere he deals with them as demonic powers that have been overwhelmed in Christ and have to be obedient to him. But they are in this sense used by God and created by God in that they do establish order. Now you take this so for granted, you don't think of it twice. But we have no policemen here at the village. We're far enough away from our society so we don't have to maintain a militia to protect ourselves. But when no one was here and we had just these good sportsmen going through here, this place was a shambles. They stole everything. They broke the windows. They smashed up the buildings, you know, just all in the spirit of good fun. This is the kind of human being we're dealing with, see. And when nobody was around and there was no authority here either, we're just lucky the place was here at all. It was a shambles. It was a wreck when we took it over. So. And this is what our society would be if there was no authority around. See. I was in Norway when the authority changed and the present authority was broken. And it was sort of interesting because here you have a Nordic kind of complex with a deep sense of law. And there was no looting or anything else. So with some glee, the citizens put their sheriff in prison because he was a Nazi. And where we were, the Nazis weren't in control. Now in Oslo they were. And that was excusable, certainly. This was a guy who used to walk along the pavement, well, here comes the sheriff sort of thing, along the walk, and everybody else got off while he swung his authority around. But in the Philippines, when I was there, and the Japanese came, the invasion came, the authorities gone, there was a while when it was really rough. Every single store had its windows broken, you know. there wasn't a place that wasn't being looted. And of course, women on the streets just were not there. You were too smart to be there, that's all. You stayed in your house. But when the authority breaks, you see, the police were still around, of course, and functioning in a sense, but they couldn't be everywhere. But this side of it is what he's talking about. That man is so made, there has to be some kind of order that ultimately has force behind it. Now, the
in
only
people... a cursory reading of this kind of thing, you would give people the idea of put up the things, you know, that vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it's all up to God, and if you wait long enough, God will change things. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers.
Well, don't avenge yourself,
yes.
Leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written. Yeah. Now, in this sense, now see, this is where Bonhoeffer came up against it. How far can you go? Because notice what the next part says. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is an authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. He is the executioner of God's vengeance. Therefore, one must be subject, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. Now you see this, for the sake of conscience, is right in the midst of this, and it's because it maintains what? An order in which there is justice. In 1933, when Hitler declared that henceforth the will of the German people was represented in his person, and he would henceforth define what the people willed, a Supreme Court justice in Berlin, a Catholic layman, a devout Christian, resigned. Because law no longer existed in Germany. Now it's easy to look back and to say, but there were those saying it then, and they weren't all Catholic by any means, and we'll talk a little bit about them later on in this discussion. But what if at that moment all those who represented order in the German society had said, he is right and we follow him into a pensionless, salaryless existence for the sake of conscience? What if the teachers had all resigned at that moment? And the preachers had all resigned at that moment? Hitler would have ceased to exist. We would not have had World War II. That we know. That he could not have gone on. Now, they didn't dare do it because they thought even Hitler is preferable to chaos. They thought all they would have is the increase of beggars in the street and the whole nation would collapse. And this is why they didn't do it. Now, they did do it in Norway. They didn't do it at once. I was angry at first. I was there. And they had a committee of 10 that were, all of them at that moment, fence-sitters. And they maintained the government law and order. And then finally, of course, Quisling took over. But at that first, in that first period in Berggrav, I was one of that committee of 10, and I was just fed up with it. And they were then actually representing the invading enemy in the name of the Norwegian citizens, maintaining some sort of government. Later, those 10 were amongst those who on one day, without the ability to correspond, without any open meeting, but with a letter from the bishops, directing them to the fact that this is what they saw as God's will, 93% of the pastors, on the same Sunday, resigned from their salaries and their pensions and their government relationship. It's the most fantastic single act in a corporate sense that we've had in the whole history of God's people. They did it, why? Because they were threatened? No. This is what astonished the government and Hitler. In no way were they threatened. Stay in your churches, we'll leave you alone. They did it because the teacher was being spied on in the classroom. The youth were being coerced into labor battalions for the German forces. And enlistments were being made in Norway for the German military machine. Those 3 points. Now here you had a Lutheran constituency, and they felt they had this from Luther as the right to do this. Luther had no sense of being kowtowing to the authorities that were. Ever. He left Wartburg, where he had gotten his life protected by the then government of Saxony, and he left and he says, God will protect you because of me. He says, don't worry, he says, you like to collect relics and and pieces of the cross and so on, I'm giving you a true cross. This was the kind of flippancy with which he dealt with this situation. And even when he was sure, he had no thought in his mind that he'd outlive the next 3 years. It never occurred to him he'd live out those 3 years. When they were begging him to marry, he says, I should marry a widow. He says, that's what I'll make her. No. I mean, he never thought he'd, and no one else thought he'd be alive in Europe at that time. You think of it, all the machinery was against him, everything was against him. In any way of outliving that particular time, because he was in rebellion then against every authority. Actually, the authority of the church, the Holy Roman Empire, which had told him to shut up, you see. And then how come his church gets so subservient, see? Because we have been. Of all the churches, only one has been worse than we have. And they have also had what we call Cicero-Papism. That's the technical name for what we have, that you believe that Caesar is the Pope. The only other one that's been worse is the Russian Orthodox. And we know what happened there. God finally used communism in order to bring his judgment upon it. For it identified with the upper classes and the rulers and was the inside and was a church practically without a mission. So this is what happens when you identify with the authority. Now Paul's speaking to a little remnant whose concern that he has is that your guests in the house, and this is a good way, I think, to put it, act like guests in the home. But if the parents are killing their children, by all means, you're supposed to stand by and say, I'm a guest in the house? See? This is the best image I know of. Or even if they're just keeping them in chains and beating them up, and then feeding them enough to keep them alive so they can beat them up again. Are you supposed to shut up and say, this is the authority? There's nothing in scriptures that in any way could even permit this kind of thinking. What you have done is you've gone, again, what Jesus says, how can you then believe if you seek honor one of another, not seek the honor from the only God? See, you have lost faith. Now, one thing we know from the time of the apostles is that not everybody was in jail by any means. Paul made it a record. And we know that they threw it back into his teeth. We're not in jail, how come you are? See? And, of course, what Paul could come back with is, well, they understand what I'm saying, and you're just repeating something. You know, because that's really what it was. It's like I say about myself. My trouble is people understand me. You know, and if you don't try to really be a communicator, you're much better off. And most ministers know this, and they don't try to communicate. They say something which satisfies themselves. Now I preach the Word of God, but actually nobody got mad. It's like Gilbert Hyatt says about teaching. It's the same thing in teaching. Any good teacher, at some time in every course, knows such a resistance in a part of his classroom that he wonders if he should wear armor into the classroom, because there comes a moment in any decently taught course when you've got those kids ready to stone you. And then comes the break, when they break through and come around. This is the thrill, isn't it? Of every decently taught course, this happens. That's true in any kind of truth, because man resists it, see? And they resist this learning process. And then comes a moment when it's sort of nip and tuck, sort of, and you wonder which way it's going to go. But a good teacher's in control. You don't lose control of the situation. And a Christian is the same way. Our Lord says, I'm telling you this in advance. So when these things come to pass, you'll know. See?
Don't you think as history goes on that people will be less and less inhibited about taking things into their hands?
For one thing,
they see that God doesn't automatically step in and take care of everything. Secondly, there's more and more history behind the most successful revolution.
Have you read Bonhoeffer at all?
No.
Well, you're speaking pure Bonhoeffer now. This is exactly the shock that he's given to the church. The way he sums up the first point, he says, the world come of age. It's no longer in that kind of tutelage. It doesn't simply lean back and say it's the will of God. Maybe there's some way we can even get the clouds to rain, you see. And we're dealing with the world come of age at this point. And we have to do it. And the other thing is that men have seen that we're not relating to something here of such sanctity that the guy stays in power because he's convinced you that God put me here. I voted for that crook. And he won't get my vote next time. That's what you say, don't you, as an American? I hope you're saying that. We had a situation of graft in our prison camp. And everybody amongst us missionaries, except one other guy, not too fond of, by the name of Don Zimmerman, and myself, we were the only two guys who were willing to kick up a fuss. The rest were mad. They said, oh, we aren't going to be here long enough anyway. Why make it tough? And we said, if we let graft come in now, there'll be no end to it. And who finally goes out of here alive will be anybody's question. But these two guys were in a shower with Donzer and myself, and that's why we got a little extra. I was losing 3/4 of a pound a day, and so I can tell you how it can happen. I, no desire to lose it that fast again. But these two fellows were looking just like we did when we came in. And that's when we say, vow to each other, we're going to hit this thing and hit it so hard that as long as we live together, there won't be any. You think at the end of our prison camp, our doctors could hardly walk. They had no memory either. Our cooks were simply flesh, a little bit of skin and bone like the rest of us, and had lost about half an inch in height like all the rest of us too. There was no graft in our prison camp. In Santa Tomas, there were about 70 people that looked almost as good as you and I look today. And there were an awful lot of people who will never see and walk again, and a lot of people dead, because they never got rid of their graft. We got rid of ours.
Do you know what graft is?
What? Graft? Well, where they were sneaking the extra helping out of the kitchen, you know, tasting the soup. It's easy for a cook to do this, you know. Mm-hmm. And seeing that the scraps that were left over were not quite scraps. We came in and ate it when nobody else was around, you know. And this sort of thing. Well, what we had to do was to have a kitchen priest, and we did.
Stealing the cans of milk,
they should have gone to babies, put
the
coffee. Yeah. Well, this is what a community means, isn't it? In a real sense. And we don't know the kind of imposition of authority that the early church operated with. And not to think historically in regard to a text like this is to not to think at all. And Paul, with a wee bit of imagination, just see it. These are little enclaves. Don't let them think of you as revolutionaries that are trying to overthrow the government. When you speak of a kingdom and a king, which they were, what could the government think? But that's what they were trying to do, you know. And this is how they would be misunderstood quite quickly.
There's something a little interesting. Now, you probably know a lot more about it than I do, but this is one of the charges used against the Christians after the Rome burned, you know. They blamed that onto the Christians. They said these Christians are always talking about hell, fire, and everything, and so just logical to blame it onto the Christians. They're always talking about fire and punishment by fire, so they must have said it.
Nero could hang him with that one quickly enough. And then you think of just eat my flesh, drink my blood. So what do they do when they're together? Sacrificing babies, you see? And why don't they let anybody else stay for communion? Because those who weren't part of the Christian faith were asked to leave at this time, and then the others were there. Well, what's going on now? And all these things were part of it. I just had a new thought in this whole text that's never occurred to me before. But notice this verse, owe no one anything except to love one another. Now, we try to run Holden Village this way. We refuse to go to a bank, and we are this way. But do you know anything else in the Christian church that operates this way? We ought to be as legalistic about that verse as this first one, I think. Huh? But we don't seem to be. We get along with the credit society very well. If we want it, we buy it and let our kids pay for it. That's what they want to do here. I mean, the original group I sat with, the men, they said, well, we're going to borrow the money and the next generation can pay for it. And I said, over my dead body, you do. Don't call me as director if that's what you want. Generations using this are the ones who are going to pay for it. Well, it's a lot cheaper to buy it now. Inflation is going to go on. I said, no question about it. But I said, we're always going to have the same kind of labor, pay a little bit more for their food as we go along, but that's it. And as far as the materials are concerned, what kind of materials do we need? It's going to get so terribly expensive. We've got to go into debt now. So one person who walked off the board wanted them to borrow $1 million. He wouldn't have helped pay for it. The idea was next generation. Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't willing to buy that, but many of them were thinking in terms of, well, we should borrow $40,000, $50,000. You know, keep going. Well, they didn't do it. I think they did one silly thing, and they do too, in terms of trying to get a little cash. That's why we sold our dock. We got $2,900 for it, but then some other kind of conniptions came in and on. That's amounted to about $1,900 we realized on it down there. But then they've quit using it now, and it is ours until the lumber quit, and then the forestry services are going to burn it down because they want us to build the one that they build on the shore. They want us to build out of the lake. You don't realize it's on the shore because there's enough water in the summertime to cover it, but it very quickly is on dry land when the lake goes down, and it's sitting up there away from the boats during about 8 months of the year. And we finally agreed, we've made incidentally there with our government. Now that's the authorities that be, and we've argued with them all along. They thought we should put $7,000 in it, or $8,000 I guess it was, and do the job. It's one of them followed up. Nobody will admit who followed up. Everybody told them they were building on dry land. Nobody would admit it, and they kept on building it. Now that's the government we should be obeying, you know. Well, they finally got it built. Then, of course, there are no more funds to do what they've already built once. Who are we going to go and get more money? But now, finally, after all these years that it's been going on, what's going to happen is that the Schlan Boat Company is going to provide the equipment we need, and the Forestry Service is going to pay for the materials, and we're going to do the work. And we'll get that dock built out, because the other one won't last too much longer. It's been there in that water for 40 years. Some parts of it are a little bit the worse for wear, as we all know. It doesn't look the same this year as it did last year. Every year it looks a little different. We've had to rebuild parts of it. But this is the government we deal with. And if you don't argue, then what? We had one of these government officials come up here who was going to grab one of our guys and take him down to jail. Nice, tough old Norske, and made much like the rest of us Norwegians are, and you've got to be hard-boiled with these guys. And I just told them, you're a guest on this property right now, and we invited you up here. Can't be civil, get off. Come back when you've got your tongue in the right place. I said, I am not your servant, you're mine, and we pay your salary. And I said, get off this place and come back when you can be decent. Well, he got off for some while. Werner said he has come back once since, when I wasn't here in all these years. That's the chief game warden for the area. One poor guy from Chicago, our first summer up here, picked up a little doe and thought it was deserted by the mother. And of course, it was what only a city citizen from Chicago would do, and it is a penal offense. It was just one of those things where he didn't know better. And like I told this guy from the game warden, I said, you'd be just as stupid in Chicago, and I hope they slap you in jail for your first infraction or something there, if it's the attitude you take. Well, he went finally, but you got to. See, what did our Lord say about Herod, you know? What did he say? Go and tell that
fox.
Yeah, go tell that fox. You see? Now, this is the language of Scripture. And when you aren't hearing it from the church, you aren't hearing a scriptural church. You're hearing a church that's sold out to what we call Cicero-Papism. I mean, for the sake of its well-being, its peaceableness, let us alone. You know, it's cop on the corner on Sunday morning directing the traffic, you know. It's in with the mayor. All these sort of things. This is what's so easy for us to do when we're an establishment. We've got something to protect. That's why we should remember that all these churches represent, and that's all the village represents. And I tell my board that, it's a tent. It may be built a little more permanent than a tent, but it's still a tent. It's a tent we can pull up and move anytime we want to. We are not anchored to this property, even to do what we're doing here, or what the church is doing where it may be. This is a tool and not an idol. Boy, what we got to do is make sure we stay with them. What if we should lose it? What if they don't renew our contract for the next 10 years? We're not worried about their not doing it. But the thing they can do here is they can always keep us off the road. But we do own the buildings, but they own the land. So our relationship to the government here is a nice little one too all the time.
They couldn't come and take the buildings and tell us to get them off the land?
They could. Yes, they could. This is why the resort down here refused to put in a swimming pool. That sort of a thing. I mean, they have a control over it. What they really could do, and legally, the only thing they could do is they could forbid us access through the road. That's all they could do legally. But that would be a stinko from here to there, and it'll never happen. What, Bill Rines would fight it? Oh, yes. That's the thing. They're on our side. But it could happen that we could get somebody to be against us, you see. There's always a problem. Now, for instance, when we built our seminary in Saskatoon, the university asked us, pled with us, build it on our campus. We'll give you the property. We'll have a community arrangement. You get joint crediting for courses and so on. And it looked just stupid for us not to do it. The president, a devout Christian, a great prophetic spirit, and a leader in community education and so on. And it looked just dumb on the part of my father-in-law and my uncle not to do it. My uncle was president of the Canadian church right then, and neither one of them would buy it. They said, no, we're not going to do it. They both liked this president very much. And you say, why? Well, we don't want to be related to the government in this way. Well, this Episcopalians are over here, United Church of Christ, you're one more. Well, who succeeds him? A guy who doesn't even know the Lord's Prayer. He doesn't. Couldn't care less, you see. And the brothers that are over there, all they got is a continual friction, aches and pains. We're just two blocks away, and our fellows can walk over there and take their courses still and get credit for them. Which they do get, and they get credit for some course they take at our seminary, because they haven't taken that away. But we still live at peace with ourselves while they have a continual feeling of sand in their shoes. Well, this is government, isn't it? And it comes and goes. And I think it's a sad thing in Norway that we're a state church. I'm opposed to it, but they've got it. In Norway, generally, the pastors are also opposed to it. The bishops were for it. That's why they have it. As I say, the problem in Norway is that the only people who have authority in the church are the bishop and the dean of the cathedral, these two men. And the average age of these men is always over 60. And their whole attitude is, oh, well, why make trouble? We aren't going to be around that much longer, see. And the rest were all opposed to going back. They went back under the church, under government, because the government asked them. And their argument was, well, it's a labor government whose premier is a pagan, he's withdrawn from the church, and yet they want us. Why shouldn't we be with them? The people in Norway did not want their church to go back under the government. They were crowding the churches then. They weren't museums. When they went back to government, they left them empty, of course. But in Denmark, it's a little different relationship. They like a state church better, but they have a different arrangement, too. Each congregation actually calls its own pastor and runs its own show, set up a little bit. Just as it is in Finland. Finland, actually, the state church there is run by the laymen themselves, not even by the pastors. And it's quite a democratic. So each one varies. But these state churches are, as we all know, foul ball. How did they get started? That's another historic thing. You see, it's nothing to do with the scripture. It's the fact that it's much easier to run a country that's only got one religion. And so they decided whatever the religion of the ruler was, would be the religion of the people. And since there were 200 principalities and so on in Germany at the time they made that agreement, it wasn't too bad. You moved 20 miles away and got in under a Catholic rule. If he stayed Catholic, and you happen to be Catholic under a Lutheran one. Or the other way around. And that went on until after World War II, when the whole thing got completely messed up, because in God's providence, it seemed that all the Catholic refugees from the East ended up in Lutheran territory, and all the Lutherans ended up in Catholic territory. So what happens? They used the same church building and discovered they weren't devils. This is some of the interesting things that have been happening to us in Germany since. And that's why there's such a vital relationship at points in the church over there right now. There's been real continuity. That's part of the background for Vatican Council II, incidentally. Yes.
Did you tell them they don't think they're losing the churches completely in the junk heap of what the Lutheran pastors did in Norway and in Denmark?
No, I told them about Norway. In Denmark, the problem was more complicated. There, they stuck their necks out and got shot. They were killed. Kai, for whom Harv and Jean have named their little boy, Kai Munk. Kai Munk was continually using the Norwegian church situation to beat the Danes with. Well, the Norwegians had, forests and mountains to flee to. The Danes had no place to flee to, except their apartment buildings on top and so on. They did a superb job, actually. It's one of the thrilling stories of human courage, what they finally did do, when they only had, the basements of apartments, and apartments are so close to each other, they lived on the rooftops and went from one to another, and used that for their underground, which they hid. But the pastor joined my best friend over there, headed, Harald Sandbeck, his name is, he headed the underground for Jutland. And his story's been written up by Reader's Digest, and it is a thrilling story. When Kai Munk was buried then, after he'd been shot, of course, all the Germans around for the funeral to make sure nothing would happen, and very dreary, desolate day, it was rainy, and they got to the end of the funeral, and everybody just sick. And suddenly somebody starts up with the Mighty Fortress is Our God. Sandbeck had come out of the underground for the funeral. And they all started in, following his lead on it. Well, then the Gestapo caught up with him and caught him. And they stuck him into Aarhus University. Well, Aarhus University is about the only university in Europe that's like our colleges over here. It has a campus, lovely buildings, all that sort of thing. None of the rest do. They're downtown places in a building you'd never guess is a university, most of them, and look pretty awful, except their new campuses, like for both Heidelberg and Oslo, built out of ways, are pretty nice. These are their medical schools and so on. They have at least new buildings, but no campuses like we think of them. Well, he was in this main building on this campus, a very lovely building, and the British Secret Service, of course, knew about it, and so they came over to kill him before the Gestapo could get the information out of him that he had, and that was when they took that low hedge-hopping flight over to bomb it. Came over from on a daylight raid, at that moment, Sandbeck says he was sitting there on the top floor of the administration building, three German guards across from him as they were about to brutalize him for getting the information, and then the bomb fell. And went right down, the building cracked right in the middle, right where he was. These three German guards killed right in front of it. It went down, but the building went down gradually where he was. And the underground picked him out of the rubble, more dead than alive, got him over to Sweden and then over to England, where he was the BBC broadcaster then for the rest of the war. But that's that little story from that side. So they had courage. The thing is, it comes down a lot of times, that's what I was going to say about Paul, it comes a lot down to your gumption, if you're willing to say it where it counts. I said to Peter before them all, see. Well, that's when communication happens. Not what I wished I'd said and I got home and told my wife, well, we know what I would have said was. That doesn't mean anything to anybody. No. But it's what they stick you into jail for saying, because you were saying where somebody else was hearing you. You see? And that's what happened to Paul, see? And so he got stuck into jail quite often. If he'd said it at midnight in somebody's house, nobody would have said anything, but he was saying it out in a street corner and stopping the traffic. You see, this is the difference, isn't it? And that's true again and again in the church's life. What was magnificent, I think, about both the German the situation in Denmark and in Norway was that they were saying it not because their life was threatened in any sense of physical life. Their psychical life was threatened. Their ability to call themselves men forever was threatened. When you allow your educational system to be manipulated, when you allow the privacy of your homes to be invaded by little kids that are taught to be spies on their own parents, you know. This was what they were saying. The gospel cannot be preached in a lie situation. And we cannot endure this lie, you see? They could have kept their pensions and their salaries and their empty pews if they'd wanted to. The interesting thing was, where did the resistance come? And that was only from the committed groups. And this is one of the things, of course, that you know about from the other countries, too. It was a specifically committed Christian group, the remnant of the church that knows Jesus Christ and lives by him, and the communists, you see. These were the two groups that had something for which they would die. And they found each other and worked together over against the occupying power. And that's what has made the relationship between the communists and the Christian church in Europe quite different than it is with us. They're not scared the same way. They met each other, they know each other, and they're still talking to each other, see? And that's where the communist still envies the Christian at one point, because when he put his neck in the noose, it wasn't annihilation for him. It was eternity. And it's that moment of truth that the communist is terribly bothered by, because it isn't enough to think that 10 generations from now there will be benefits from this, you see. It's nice if you can think it, but even that is a pretty dim hope. But this relationship to government is such. Now, how have our churches in the communist countries found it? They have been able to exist, haven't they? They've been able to carry on. They do their work. It's an emasculated situation sometimes, but they're still moving, because we still are not a church which is concerned ultimately about who the ruler is. And that truth remains here. We would never carry on a revolt. It would be unthinkable. It's impossible in Christian terms to have a revolution to get a Christian ruler, because the one you happen to have is a pagan. In our prison camp, I got a real organization going to elect a fellow who was an atheist to our church, our camp, because we had too many missionaries on it right then. And one thing about this atheist is that he had a sense of justice. He was fair-minded. It's such a sense of justice that about 2 weeks after he got elected, and we had the first chance to go out of the camp in the whole time, and I drew on the lucky numbers and let me go down and unload the Red Cross shipment, finally came through. And he says I couldn't go because I'd been in the hospital for 4 weeks. And so I hadn't been doing my camp work. And I said, nuts, I've been back on this kitchen crew for such a time and so on, and argued with the camp council, and they agreed. So I got a chance to go. That's how fair-minded he was. And he was a very unhappy guy, very morose fellow. But he had a sense of justice. And that's what we look for, isn't it, in a ruler? If there is no justice in the land, can a Christian still obey that kind of a government? If you don't know what time of night they're going to come and pull you out, okay, maybe you can still obey that government. But you can't do it if you know they're going to do the same thing to your neighbor. For his sake, you can't do it. For conscience sake, you see. That government which no longer exists to maintain order, but disrupts it. That government which no longer exists to establish justice, but subverts it, is not a government. It's demonic. And it can become either one. And that's why this word exousiai always has an ambivalence in the scripture. It is a demonic power at times. Go ahead, you guys discuss that.
What is it? You said it's confrontation between Christians and communists.
Yeah. In the resistance movement during World War II, yeah, in every one of the countries. These are the two groups which led the resistance movement. And you have a funny series of stories during the 40s, the last five years of the 40s, right after World War II, we've got them all in the library now. You can read on it and laugh about it. And that says, what's this crazy priest again down there?
Don Camillo.
Yeah, Don Camillo. You know, all these stories about Don Camillo in Italy, they're in our library and they're fun to read. And he and the communist mayor are always sparring with each other. And of course, the two had been the leaders of the underground. Now, when they're out from under it, there is actually an undertow of affection in spite of this continual overt hostility.
Then Bonhoeffer would be a good example of what that type of thing was.
Yeah.
Because he gave his life.
He gave his life for it, that's right.
Well, and Bart had a kind of an interesting angle on that too. Did he throw on that? The possibility, I said it was impossible for a Christian to live under the Nazis, but it was possible to live under the communists?
Yes, this is why a lot of Americans don't like Barth. You know, Karl Barth has said this consistently, that it's possible for a Christian to live under communists, but it's impossible under Nazis. Now, it's possible, but not very pleasant, let's put it that way, and of course Barth would too. But on the other hand, he would also say on the other side, but it's likely to be less subversive to Christianity for a Christian to be under communism, where he never has a chance to mingle with the power complex, than it is under capitalism, where sometimes he controls the power complex and then gets caught by it. And Barth said this consistently. It's got a lot of people mad. But before he ever said it, the Archbishop of Canterbury said it, William Temple said it very clearly during World War II, that it's much better, if that's the choice, that the church gets subverted by the government than that the government gets subverted by the church. If there has to be a situation of domination, then far better the church is dominated by the government than the government's dominated by the church, because it destroys the church every time. Because every time, well, who do you know any place that holds power of that kind that doesn't get infected by it? See? And when you have that kind of charismatic power that the church gives, you see, and then you get a legal imputation of power that the government can give and combine it in one person. This is a vicious thing. Only Jesus Christ can take that. See, that's why he's the Messiah. See?
It can sometimes look awfully good at the start. I mean, like you can see how it got started at the time of Constantine. I mean, the Christians had already seen the rock develop in Rome, you know, and they had pagan emperors, and then suddenly you get Constantine, a Christian emperor. Yeah.
And it was peace. Don't forget, it was a peace that lasted for 300 years.
And then he
got out of
his capital and goes to Constantinople, and they're all going to start a new city completely from scratch, and here's this wonderful opportunity to start a Christian community from scratch. And
many of them believe this was the millennium.
Yes.
This is when the kingdom started.
You can understand how they might have gone along with this.
In fact, even today, under sects that have maintained this underground kind of an idea, you run into sects in America that believe the millennium started with Constantine and went for 1,000 years, and since that, it's been the reign of the Antichrist.
And if you read the documents of that time, they're all very optimistic. And then, of course, Constantine called the council, and he attended it in person, and that kind of thing, and they really thought they had it made.
There's a good play on that by Dorothy Sayers that's really interesting and gives you the history. This is called Emperor Constantine, but allows you to see this more positively. But of course, what happened then was immediate corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Corruption even of the texts of the New Testament, the lousiest texts we have in Greek, come from those Bibles that Constantine had printed, because he could get smart guys to do it. And so instead of stupid slaves doing it like they had been before, the kind the Christians could afford to get their Bibles copied, then you got smart slaves, and that's where you got all these varieties in the text, see? Because they changed it. That's bad grammar. We don't use that phrase anymore. Gee, what an old-fashioned phrase. Dress it up. And so that's the text that's behind the King James instead. The King James text has those texts behind it that we call the blue-purple vellum. They were made with beautiful purple parchment, and Constantine had thousands of them made at a time to give away, you see, and this sort of thing. And they improved on the New Testament, you know, dressed up these. So our later text, what we've done, has gotten back to the bad Greek with which John originally wrote, see? There you get the mistakes that Mark made when he was quoting. So you do say, as it says in the prophet Isaiah, when it's Malachi that he's quoting as well as Isaiah. See? But, you know, it was a smart guy that did it for Constantine. He changed it over. He says, as the prophet said, see? Mark's wrong here. His source is right, you know.
It's sort of mistranslated to those slaves, for the King James. And
well, that's right. Well, at times they do. See, you have a little editorializing in it at times. But they are not, though that King James Version is based on one late text where you have an actual mistranslation too. That's where you're thinking of in 1 John. But that actually comes only in a corrupt text from the 13th century. And Erasmus, unfortunately, because he changed this and was in the Latin, the Vulgate, see, Erasmus had rashly said, if you can show me one Greek text in which this occurs, I'll change it. Well, and they found this Greek text, so we had to change it, but it was a translation from the Latin Vulgate, the Greek text. That's where the mistranslation occurred. And then, of course, you do have the fact that you're using certain things in the church's life, you tend to read it back into the Bible. I mean, the ending of the Lord's Prayer, for instance, got added to the Lord's Prayer in the Scriptures because they were saying, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, you know, so that got stuck back, tacked down to the original. But some things went way back, like the ending of Mark comes from the ending of the second century. We even know the monk who did it, he's a pious monk, and he felt Mark ought to end with the resurrection, not whether they were afraid, so he stuck Luke and Matthew together to make an ending for Mark. Some of those things.
Could you explain the teaching for Hobbes' idea of salvation of the plural?
I could. Explain yourself more, because I couldn't, but we could discuss it.
Talking about all the church today, of course, salvation is an individual matter between me and God.
Yeah.
But also as a group matter, the church on earth. But I was wondering if you haven't read anything.
No, I wouldn't be able to. I mean, I don't know where he has developed that except just commenting. Like so much of his stuff, it's just sort of a, you know, comment that he makes. But it would be consistent with the exegetical background for the word to justify. The word justify in the New Testament is a communal term and not an individual one. And so the salvation is always a group event. Like I mentioned today on Luther's insight is exactly the same. You know, this 14 of consolation in the 9th chapter called the consolation of the right hand. You are saved when you're with it, when you're with the community, when you're part of it, when you're rejoicing in it. Or even if you've got it going rough, you still know that the church is praying for you and that not every battle is being lost on every front just because you're losing years on years, you know. So there's a sense of living in and with and for one another. This is what he means by it, and the same thing Luther does, incidentally. There isn't such a thing as the kind of salvation that the 19th century put into this awful painting where you had Rock of Ages, which is a 19th century hymn and not a bad one for the individual aspect of salvation, but you have a guy hanging onto a cross on a rock in the midst of a stormy sea and he's got both hands on there, you know. And I said, this can never be scriptural. One hand's all that's necessary, your other hand's on a brother. You know, you're holding one guy up in the waves. And that's what it always is in the scripture. And you always are together in it. And this is another side we can take up another evening, because it would go into some more discussion on universalism, the idea of the hope that you have continually for all men to be saved that's continued there in Scripture. Paul specifically says in the 9th, 10th, and 11th chapters of Romans, then all Israel will be saved. You know, the sense of a community event in salvation is a real thing in the Scriptures. And our missions are trying to capture this, aren't they, today? One of the big things of missions in this middle 20th century is trying to see a kind of statesmanship which doesn't mock this group conversion that we used to mock. You know, all Norway got converted at the same time. The Saxons were beat up so badly finally by having so many battles, they finally gave up, you know, and they stuck the whole army in a river, and the priest got up the riverways and blessed the water, and he just rushed over the whole gang. You know, it was either your head off or you were going to get some water on it. Okay, you take the water. You know, but today we see much more the meaning of this. And for instance, one of the great Jewish spirits of our century, a tremendous woman, was converted during World War II as part of the underground. See, in the underground, a lot of people got converted. See, this is the crazy thing. Suddenly these groups were mingling that never had. And Christ does reign, and they were being captured by him. This happened to a lot of communists too, incidentally. And she came through, she was converted, but she wouldn't accept baptism. She says, I will not accept baptism until all Jewry comes in. How can I, she says, deny my people who are still without Christ by accepting baptism? See her problem here? You can see her problem. Okay. See, so here you have this real sense of the plural in salvation.
In that situation, don't you think it worked against her own thinking?
Well, she kept writing. She is a specifically Christian witness in her books. This is Simone Weil, W-E-I-L, Simone Weil. And she's got some great things.
Did it bolster her own, did it help her to work all the harder for herself?
For the Jew, yes. She wrote her books in this regard and gave this kind of witness. And she even tries to move in closer to the Jewish kind of intensity by, I think, a wonderful kind of analogy that she makes once. She said, you cannot work a math problem that's hard and concentrate totally on it without being that much closer to God, because this is an act of worship. This is a commitment, you see. She's trying to move over to get to them as to what actually it means to be identified with God. And it's not a bad analogy. And of course, she's not the only one, and these have made a tremendous shock in the Jewish world. There's a reason why we get so much back and forthness today between us.
Was she ostracized by her people?
She remained in relationship to them because she never accepted baptism and went over, so she could still talk with them. But she didn't live too much longer. What was it, TB, Mary, that she had?
She lived for the poor. And,
yeah.
And she was poor. And
gave herself
worked
to them.
For them and
she came out of the communist movement.
Lived in that kind it was after in the Reconstruction of France,
right after World War II. She only lived a couple of years before she died. She was in her early 30s. She was converted in England, actually.
She was converted by Roman Catholic. And she was related to the Roman Catholic Church, and she has a whole series of letters to a Roman Catholic priest who tried to, to convince her that she should take the sacraments. And and her letters back to him clarify the situation. It's a very revealing kind of witness of what she understood by it. She was completely committed to Jesus Christ and the New Testament. But she felt that she had to stay on the outside in order to win the outsider.
It seems to me like it must have been a completely unselfish act on her part. And even though it's against what Jesus said, he said be baptized. Seems like because she was doing what she was doing, she dedicated to Christ that, God's grace would cover her.
She did in her name, that's right, and she's under the baptism of the cross. Now, the Chinese, they have a real tough on the other side, and I remember when one of our teachers finally accepted baptism, when her blood finally got to her, that this was unfilial on her part in the ultimate sense not to do it. Because she said, I will not be filial in being baptized when my parents and my parents' parents have not been baptized. And so I think of Confucianists with a sense of, the whole worship of the ancestors. And then the way she was finally brought over was to see, but the ultimate unfiliality is to God, your Heavenly Father. You can leave them in His hands when they hadn't had the opportunity that is now being given to you. You see? And this for her was enough. But it was a different situation for Simone Weil there. She wasn't relating vertically to a bunch of dead answers. She was relating horizontally to a whole community still outside the gospel.
I was once invited to a meeting of converted Jews. I think they were some of the strongest Christians I ever met because evidently once a Jewish person gets baptized, they hold in his family some kind of a symbolic burial, and from then on his family and friends don't associate with him at all.
Well, look at Tiny Tim. Honest, Pete, he's crazy. I don't know, have you seen Esquire for last month? I'd say if I were the first one on the moon, they've got these various ones, Humphrey's got his little saying. Tiny Tim's got he's the longest one in there by five times. He said, I'd say I take over the name of Jesus Christ through whom all are redeemed. He says, I know there are beings on other planets, but they all belong to Jesus Christ. And this is the way he goes on. this crazy goop. Yeah. He was in Minneapolis last summer and they were interviewing him on TV. And one of our neighbors, who's an atheist, has a column, and he wrote it in his column afterwards. They asked him, what's the greatest event? What?
Who is that?
Jones. Will Jones. Will Jones.
Yeah.
And he had said on TV they were questioning him, and he says, what's the greatest event in your life? He says, well, Jesus Christ, of course.
What else?
Yeah. And then Will Jones says, there's about 30-second silence. Nobody said anything. It's just a big embarrassment in the city of Billy Graham and the American Luther Church. But it's true. The Jew has a spontaneous kind of a witness.
Was he
Jewish?
Yeah, he
was Jewish. Well, I'm going to close this by one other thought in complete contrast to what I've said on our own government. I think part of the reactionary spirit in our American government, part of our backing reactionaries around the world, part of our involvement in Vietnam right now, where we're the anti-revolutionary element, is because we still have this feeling of guilt as a revolutionary-born nation. And so we tend to go to the opposite extreme. And this is trouble. When you begin in one extreme, you can so easily drift over to another. And I would throw that out still for your confusion. This is the difficulty about taking the law into your own hands to do something, is how do you relate afterwards again? Because authority always has to be reestablished. And yet, can it be established? Look at look at England is over against us, against whom we revolted. They got far more liberty than we have. Eccentrics dwell in every town, and they like eccentrics. The opposition always is wide open in their kind of society. The minute any government cannot hold a majority of people, it collapses and you've got to elect a new one. No. And whereas we can go along with a president for another 3 years after he's already lost the biggest popular vote he ever had. And there aren't 25% of the people who would vote for him again. He's in there for another 3 years, and so he's going to actually operate in very peculiar ways when he knows he no longer has a popular will with him. But England is quite a different country. So if we'd stayed with her, what would our liberties be like? Would we be in Vietnam now?
What makes you think we still have a guilt feeling about having revolted?
I think this is why we react on the reactionary side so often. We certainly have not played ball with it. I listened in the United Nations one day, and the World Series was on, so there were very few of us there that day when France walked out. And we were defending France and Algeria at a time there wasn't a decent Frenchman defending his government. But we as a nation were defending it. And when the vote came down, you know, and all the little nations were voting against us, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, they all voted against us. But we stayed with the colonial power and colonialism.
Well, do you think that was just a matter of sticking by our friends or?
NATO.
Yeah.
NATO. We had to keep our NATO commitments.
Yeah.
But where's our conscience, you see?
That still doesn't necessarily trace back to the Revolutionary War.
No, but how can we who revolted against colonialism have become one of the great sponsors of colonialism, except for that sense of guilt in it, I think. I think that this is your problem with revolutions. It tends to always develop its extremes. And just in the same English-speaking world, we still have the Englishman with his tongue in cheek, you know, on our commitment to our Don Quixote kind of a policy where we think we're the good guys over against the bad. And you know, England isn't convinced. Sometimes we push her. Canada isn't convinced. They think we're dead wrong on Castro, and they're still smoking Havana cigars in Canada. When I can get them from Canada. This is the problem, I think, always, you see. And so there's this side of it that you still have to say is there, that it's always much better. And I my whole life is committed to this. Continuity and renewal, not discontinuity and revolution. To me, this is everything. That means it takes all intelligence and patience and bearing with that you can, and the realization that there is never such a thing as an absolute right. It's only a rough justice, consistently, isn't it? And you settle for this rough justice over and over again.
Yeah, but it seems like we can never correct social wrongs that are developing. They always got to get about so bad
that they stink.
But you do get into these discontinuous situations.
This is right. And this is where
including Christians aren't smart enough to see them as they're developing.
Amen. And I agree. This is the element of the demonic in history. I love this one illustration. I've used you before this summer, those who've been around. But it's a good illustration that the history of the last 300 years has been like a triangle, each of whose angles is liberty, equality, fraternity. And in the 18th century, the great word is liberty, and the closer man got to liberty, the less there was of equality or fraternity. In the 19th century, the great word became equality. And the more we got of equality, the less there was of either liberty or fraternity. And now in the 20th century, God help us while we go after fraternity. Oh. There'll be neither liberty nor equality. Just big brother, see.
Did you discuss this continuity renewal thing with Will?
Yeah, literally, privately with him, talking about. No, I still think that's the only thing. I wasn't around when he gave his talk on violence. I'll have to listen to that.
Well, I didn't surmise from that that it would have been continuity and renewal.
No,
I don't think they feel that there's a possibility.
No.
See, and this
and
is.
Yet, and yet, can't you understand? You can understand.
Oh, and not only that, I know. Like I did, I said my ambivalence towards you, Will, is the fact that it's only because you've taken to the sword that I find a respect for the black, whereas before I had a pity for him. Now I respect you. Now you're gaining your dignity.
So does he go along with this idea of revolution being the opposite extreme?
No, Marty brought this up. What is he going to do about the fact when he's in?
Mm-hmm.
Then where does the judgment come on him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see, this is what there's no room for, and that's why you know it's wrong. Because all you can do is absolutize his right. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say, for instance, when I read Fanon, out here we've got the wretched, you know, the revolt of the wretched. My first thought is to go home and buy a machine gun. If it comes to that, I'll have to fight too. And of course, where will I be? On the side of the white, naturally, you see? Because if we're going to take to the streets, that's what's finally going to happen, you know. And this is where we're going to find ourselves, because you can't jump out of your skin any more than he can. And this is where somewhere, before it comes to that point, we have to hope that they have gained their dignity.
And we have sensitive.
And that we have got enough openness to allow it, you see.
Right.
And that's what we're fighting for here in the village. See? And that's why I'll have Willie back in. But that's what we're fighting for. And that's what we're fighting for in our societies, Christians, isn't it? That we're going to be open to them, and yet we're not going to allow this develop to where it comes to armed conflict. You see, but I do think that's why I told I call him Negro Zen. So that's what I will now, Negro Lieutenant in the army, and we had just been freed 3 days since the army had come in, and there were a few taverns opening up now around in the area. And what did they have over them? Off limits to colored personnel. I said, you guys got the guns. I said, I'd hate to see this happening to a bunch of Norwegians. Why don't you use these guns? And I think this is the way we feel. Humanly speaking, this is how we feel. And we're glad the black has gotten to this point where he's starting to see,
mm-hmm.
I'm not just going to sit there and let him walk over me.
And
he's getting his...
And he hasn't gotten to this point today by allowing the present to continue.
No,
he just hasn't, you know.
But he's at least revolting, isn't he? And we're grateful for that,
mm-hmm.
even though you say this.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I question, you know, the commitment to continuity.
I still say that's the only way it's going to be anything. If he gets revolt, then discontinuity, then we're going to have armed conflict, and I'm going to be shooting down the black. But it has to go so far that it can shock us into response, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And this is where he's right.
They don't want violence.
Yeah.
Ultimately,
yeah.
he hopes it doesn't come to that. You know that, and so do I.
Yeah.
And actually, they feel that the blacks have a messianic message of eventual nonviolence, non-materialistic standards of living, and so on. I mean, this is really what the sort of goals.
Yeah. Or it's just the whole
and if they can get a hearing, this is what they want to get across.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't want, you know, sort of an adjustment.
It's just so confusing whenever your means don't, you know.
I know.
I
but you can see how even in his revolt, something illustrated this today, which we'll close now if you want to knock it out. And that is my argument that Paul is getting at, is we all have to be subject to one another. If it was just Willie and Willie saying this, it wouldn't mean nothing. But it's because a whole group are organized and they send word up here and he doesn't even know why. Come on out and call us up.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got to go 55 miles to make a telephone call when he's just enjoying himself up here and planning to go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
He could have sent back, I'm sorry, I'll see you 6 days later, see,
mm-hmm.
when I'm coming out of here anyway. He didn't, you see. He's subject.
He had to go.
You see. And he didn't know if he'd see his wife ever again, and certainly if he'd see her in 6 weeks. He didn't know if it was a hot situation, some city he was going into or what, when he went out. Actually, it was just simply, again, power fight within the organization that he was asked for judgment on. But that's what it means to be committed, see?
Mm-hmm.
You're not on your own. Willie isn't on his own. And if you and I are simply on our own, we're uncommitted. And then we are destroyed. And that's what Paul's getting. We're all committed. We're part of a community that's bigger than us. And this we have to see. That's why, that's all the difference, say, in our community here between the Peter Pans who are no longer with us, and say, Doug, who is? His community is bigger. He's big enough to relate, discuss, dialogue between, which allows community to actually exist. Whereas all the Peter Pans did, the little kids were earlier, going around, and they established their own little daydream world and played. They were toads and birds or whatever they were that particular night. Had their little family in their little nest. Yeah, they flew about. And it was just sad. You thought, is this what's going to happen? And what's going to happen? Then, of course, the demonic force of our civilization just simply grow large enough to squash them, don't they? And that we cannot do.
Don't you think it's incumbent on the duty of every Christian to see injustice in his everyday life, to be wide awake for it, and do something about it while there's a chance to do something?
Yeah, you've got to move in.
And not let things develop. Yeah. I like you take this colored business in the South. I mean, here's been going on all generation after generation, right under the noses of Christians, and they put up with it and haven't done a thing about it.
We had to do what we could. Now, from our North to the South, it carried slowly. We saw it with the missionaries. But at least when our youth made a motion, no church has the right to name Christian, that makes a difference on the basis of color.
Yes.
We got letters from around the South that were real angry. See?
Yes.
But at least we made the point. But that doesn't mean too much, because that's all it was. But when it comes to the Peace Corps being set up, and I'm violent there because I've been fighting to get something like this and been in Washington twice, tried just to get money moved out of State Department for international scholarships for this and so on. And so I've got an interest in it, and I've been handling it. Then I fight, and I did, and I didn't get anywhere. And I told Humphrey, how can you do this? How can you make this another instrument of national policy? That's no Peace Corps, see? Unless you open this up to at least be NATO, so it could be a Western kind of a thing. But I said, it has to be. You've got to have communist kids in with that. You've got to open it up to behind the Iron Curtain countries, or it's just so much of a fiasco. And of course, Humphrey's argument back was, and I've got the correspondence from his argument back, it was being tough enough to win this one without trying to try that one, see? He was arguing as a politician, we better get what we can gain. I was amazed. When I saw the arguments in public of the senators against the Peace Corps, I couldn't believe it. These were sensible men. How could they even be thinking that thing? You know how opposed they were to it? It barely went over. So he was right. That's all we could gain right then. We can't think outside our national complex. This is what it proved to me. Our egotism is simply too... That's how little Christ has gained as far as our general public. We as Christians can. And I suppose we're coming closer and closer to the point where we're going to have sort of cross the board as Christians that... there's going to be kind of, or the CO will be seen as having the only point of view we can have. I haven't believed this yet, because my major problem still is what happened to me when I once had that point of view, and then I had to shift it, and that was the treatment of the Jew in Germany. You just can't stand back by and let that happen, that's all.
But there are Christians now who listen to the Negro because he's armed.
So yeah.
They hop on the bandwagon to see if there's injustice being done, but there are other oppressed people, like the poor.
Yeah.
They don't pay too much attention to them. They don't pay too much attention to the people who are ill, or maybe even unjustly in mental hospitals like that. So that sort of thing doesn't bother them.
Well, we hope that whoever we got that we're paying to be at that particular point is doing some shouting for us. That's all we can hope, isn't it? Unfortunately, they usually are. You know, we aren't that corrupt yet, but what our establishment men who are at that particular point, they aren't quite like the government establishment men. We had a bunch of military out in the Philippines, and they didn't even know the points to watch for bombers. We'd been having picnics, at least, instead of...